episode 15 of Whole PTSD. Across from me is Dr. Jana Price Sharps and Dr. Matthew Sharps. Guys, thanks for coming by. And wow, I can't believe we're on 15. That's quite amazing.
That crazy? That's wonderful. How exciting.
It's been about a year, but as me and you were talking this past week, we decided we were going to kind of make this the anniversary type show, given that the anniversary of the Mingler shooting is this coming Monday, and just kind of a commemorative experience for us and for the listeners and
absolutely
everyone out there. So why don't you give everybody a little bit of a rundown on what we're going to do today?
So Chandler and I were talking about what happens with anniversaries, and we decided that maybe we do a little bit different kind of podcast today and do a roundtable podcast, and with all of us chatting about what happens to the body and the mind with anniversaries. What are some things that you can do if you've just gone through a traumatic event? How is that going to affect you with anniversaries? And so it's a little bit different episode, but I think it might provide some really useful information for everybody. So I'm excited about the episode.
I know I'm kind of jacked up in a good way, and I imagine you guys probably are too. You know, we had a very traumatic incident happen in Porterville, California this past weekend, and kind of excited to do what we can to help those folks. And I as you mentioned before the show started, is that this is a great way to show that there's hope at the end of the tunnel. This is the start of a maybe a long journey, maybe a short journey, who knows, but it's a journey that will get you to a good place.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, Janice, so what's the importance of celebrating the anniversary of something tragic? Is that kind of a hard thing for people to go through?
It depends on the mindset. Some people will look at it that I'm okay and my family's okay and we survived. I think the anniversaries are more difficult if you've lost somebody you care about, like our recent Porterville fire. I think that's particularly hard because many people knew those guys. We had a very large fire in the last recent history called the Campfire. A lot of losses during that. So I think when there's loss of human life, it's much more difficult with the anniversaries. And so thinking in terms of how to view that and what to do with that and how to do that, it's a very mindful process. And I think that's why we decided to talk about it today.
One thing that really comes to mind with this case, the Porterville fire in particular, is that these guys were so young. Does that play a factor? I mean, what's the brain kind of doing when we kind of see someone younger as opposed to someone older? It's still tragic, but it makes things just a little harder to grasp, right?
Well, and also you don't have a chance to say goodbye. So you don't have any kind of closure. I've told people many times, if you lose somebody and you don't have closure, whether you're a civilian or you're a first responder, sometimes writing them a letter, I know that sounds kind of odd, but the brain really does seek closure. It wants to be able to frame something and then put it away. And when you don't have that kind of closure, then you have to kind of think about what would help my brain get that closure. I've actually had people say, okay, if your friend that you lost was sitting in my office, what would you want to say to him today? You know, so I've done it that way as well. But however they do it, they need to give their brain some closure. You know, whether it's just speaking to them, whether it's writing them, whether somehow to say goodbye to that person, I think that's really important. I think that realize that your brain, especially initially during grieving, is going to go all over the place. Grieving is, I think, one of the hardest things for people to do because it feels so very out of control. Usually I have people say, what is the matter with me? I feel fine, and then I'm watching TV and a commercial comes on and I'm bursting into tears. Am I crazy? What is going on? And I'm like, yeah, no, you're not crazy. Your brain's just grieving. And so it's going to go all over the place. One minute you're going to be sad, and 30 minutes later you might be mad. Then you're going to be irritable. Then you're going to be fine. And then people get stuck into what they should be doing. So I've had guys say, but I feel fine. What's wrong with me? You know, I should feel terrible today. Well, your brain is going to go back and forth through that. Let it do what it has been made to do. It knows how to grieve. we get involved in that process and start trying to monitor it. And when we try and monitor it, we do the woulda, shoulda, couldas and the shoulds and all of that. And that always messes things up. Just let your brain go up and down as it needs to. You know, I understand at work, you've got to kind of shut that process down. But when you are on your own downtime, if you need to go to the bathroom and cry, go to the bathroom and cry. You know, one of the wonderful things about sad tears is it releases serotonin. And that's one of our feel-good neurotransmitters. So if you're trying to stop the tears and you're off duty, you're actually depriving your body of some feel-good neurotransmitters that are going to calm your whole system down. So instead of reaching for the beer, let yourself cry and feel better. But let your brain go up and down and don't be afraid of that. It's not going to do that forever. It's going to feel chaotic. I understand that, but just let it do what it needs to do. Mm-hmm. Step back and let it do it.
Dr. Matthew, from the non-clinical perspective, what's your take on all that and what's this grieving thing all about?
Well, if you think about a horrible event like the Minkler shooting, what it is now is information. It's a strange way of looking at it, but what you have now is a memory, and a memory is information. Now, the brain is geared to deal with information in different types and different ways, okay? We tend to distinguish central information from peripheral information. Now, central information is the specifics to this particular thing. If I can use an example, you take an elephant. Most people have seen an elephant, at least in a zoo or a circus, and there's that elephant. He's a certain shade of gray, has certain tusk shapes, et cetera, et cetera. But you also have this relational information, this peripheral information that, you know, elephants, modern elephants live in the tropics. They're related to each other. They're, you know, African and Indian elephants. They're big animals. Well, what's important about that is that the brain tends to put a priority on the central, specific information to the exclusion of the more peripheral relational information. Okay, we tend to think more about this elephant rather than elephants in general. Now, you go to something like the Minkler shooting, all right? And here's your memories of what happened. Well, those are very specific to that shooting. This is what happened, this horrible thing happened, etc., etc. But it's not happening now. It happened in the past. But your brain tends not to focus on that. Your brain puts you into the experience, more or less, so to speak, like you're experiencing this elephant rather than the idea that elephants in general. Now, suppose you suddenly had an elephant turn up in the parking lot. This is where the situation kind of breaks down, but suppose this happens, right? Well, you're really going to be focused on that elephant. It's not really going to be thinking, well, my gosh, an elephant shouldn't be in the parking lot. I don't understand this. Elephants belong in zoos, right? And if you go to the zoo, well, you get to see elephants because they take care of them there and feed them there, and you pay to go see them, right? Well, when you're at a zoo, you never think about those factors. You think about this elephant. Okay, now, you don't see an elephant in the middle of a parking lot, usually, but you will suddenly have the Minkler shooting come to your head, okay? You know its various cues, okay, it's that date, and then, which is relational information, but bang, you're back in the situation. What you're seeing is not in the parking lot, it's in your head, the central specific information. And you tend not to start going, well, wait a minute, that was a long time ago, it was in a different place. Now I'm in Fresno or Hanford or LA or wherever it is. Now things are different. This is not really happening. This is just information. That's why in cases of PTSD, many clinicians, including Jenna, have found this to be the case. It's so important to ground the person right now. You're about to go into something like a daytime intrusion. Well, no, look at your watch. That's not the watch you had back in the field. It's the watch you have now. Look at your sleeves. You're not in uniform. You're wearing civilian clothes. You look out the door, you're seeing a parking lot in L.A. or Hanford rather than, you know, back in the desert, back in the jungle, or back at Minkler. And so the fact that these different types of information can be dealt with in that way, that you can recognize, okay, these central aspects of the experience are no longer happening. But the brain tends not to do that unless you literally put the brain into that state where you focus on, I'm here now, it's not the same situation, and, you know, I'm not in Minkler, I'm not at that time, these horrible things aren't happening.
So, scientifically, you know, it's been 10 years since Minkler. Could just the date of Minkler, I believe it's February 25th, excuse me if I'm wrong on that, but so let's just say, you know, it's February 25th, you're 10 years from now, could that trigger, just merely being that the fact that it's February 25th, could that trigger PTSD syndromes?
Absolutely, because it goes directly to what we were just talking about. In general, the Minkler shooting is back there in time. It's related to other events in that it's back there in time. But now it's the specific date. You have a name for it. This particular date, this particular moment, oh my gosh, that is exactly when the Minkler shooting happened. So here's a piece of, this gets a little insanely complicated, right? But relational information. Minkler's related to this date, but now the date is concretized. It's the same date again. Yeah. And the mind starts treating that as a central core fact. Okay, and so all of a sudden, so to speak, you've got the elephant in the parking lot. Okay, here I am now. Now I have an absolute concrete reason to replay the Minkler, the horrors of that shooting in my mind. And what you wind up doing then is focusing on the shooting rather than on the surround of it, rather than the fact this was a long time ago, it was in a different place, you know, many things have moved on since then. You don't focus on that. You're right back in the situation. More or less, you know, instead of an actual real physical elephant out there, you've got the, what is not real, it's a memory. It's just information, but that memory becomes real in your mind right now, and you're reliving it.
Wow. Wow. So, Jana, if, you know, you find yourself on the anniversary of your tragic event, and you're irritable, or maybe you're getting your daytime intrusions or whatever, how do you go about dealing with that and grounding yourself and getting back to a good place?
So, what Dr. Sharps is talking about, that grounding, is going to be really important. And to realize, I'm going to talk about what he talked about a little bit clinically.
Sure.
Realize that crime scene or that scene no longer exists. That battlefield no longer exists. Whatever that trauma was is no longer there. And so, as Dr. Sharps said, that's in your mind, it's a memory, but it's no longer reality. And so sometimes what I'll have folks do is I'll say, anytime that comes up, I want you to see yourself driving away or flying away or whatever your mode of transportation is, away from that event and going home. And what that does is it gives the part of the brain that is still bothered by that, it gives that a visual representation of, oh, that is ended. I kind of see PTSD almost like if you turned on your computer and you opened up, I don't know, 300 YouTube videos all at once, and then the computer crashes. And so what I do as a clinician is I help them go event by event and close those YouTube videos. And one of the ways to do that is to visualize the event itself closing so that the brain goes, oh, that's historical. It's no longer a current event. Because I think that the brain almost sees it as still going on. And so here's what people typically do with PTSD. They will, they're sitting on the couch and suddenly they realize it's February 25th and it's Minkler. So now they're back there and they're thinking about it. And then they go, oh my gosh, I don't want to think about this. I need to shut my brain off. I don't want to think about this. And now their adrenaline goes up. Well, if you think about the brain is basically your early warning system, then the brain goes, oh my gosh, we have adrenaline and we're thinking about Minkler. That means Minkler's still happening because we're getting all amped up. That means it's still unsafe. That means it's still a problem. So we have to keep this YouTube video open. And so when you give your brain a visualization of it closing, then the brain goes, oh, okay, well, that sucked, but it's over. Right? And so anything that you can do with your brain to help it understand it's over helps the brain begin to close those YouTube videos. So, for instance, we had Doc Burry on here, and he talked about going back to Vietnam and burying the hatchet. And he talked about seeing that whole field, but there's no warfare there. It's just a big green field. And so that began to change the visualization and break up what I call a freeze frame. Because when people relive events, they don't live, like Dr. Sharp said, they don't live the whole event. They live bits and pieces of that event. So they might see, unfortunately, the dead body, or they see somebody shooting, or they see a friend falling, or whatever they're seeing, but they don't see people arriving and leaving and, you know, people talking to each other and dispatch, and they don't see all of that. They just see these little freeze frames. And so as long as those freeze frames stay freeze frames, the brain is still going to see that event is still happening. So when I break up those freeze frames, then the brain kind of almost re-encodes it as a historical event. So anything you can do to close those YouTube videos without being afraid of them. When you start fearing your own mind, that's when the mind starts pumping a bunch of adrenaline in the system and going, oh my gosh, we're in crisis. We don't know quite sure why we're in crisis, but we need to monitor everything. And then that's where the irritability comes from, because they go into fight mode, because our first responders don't go into flight mode. They go into fight mode, and then everything starts to play havoc at the house, basically.
Right. A lot of what we're talking about here is allowing yourself to move on. That's something you say a lot of times, and allowing yourself to move on and go forward. How do you do that when, you know, when you have an incident where you lose, like Minkler, you lose two officers, Porterville, you lose two firefighters, I almost feel like there would be kind of this connection of you don't want to let go because you don't want to forget those people or the memory of the people. So how do you differ the two?
Well, I find that, to be honest with you, I find that people that have religious beliefs tend to do better with us. People that are atheists, that is a little bit harder, but it's still doable. To be able to see those people as either going on and they're in a better place, or they're just not there, right? And so at the end of the day, those people are at peace. And thinking truly about what would those people want from you? Would they want you to sit there and be absolutely miserable every day? No, because if you believe in an afterlife, they're going, move on, I'm happy, you know. And depending on what you believe, I'm in a better place than you are. So, hey, don't worry about me. I'll see you on the next round or, you know, later on. And so I think that's a really important point, not to get stuck in, if I heal, am I betraying them? Because they've gone on ahead of you. They left you. You're not leaving them because, see, they're no longer on the battlefield. They're no longer, in this case, in the library. They're no longer at the shooting in Minkler. They're on ahead of you, wherever that means for you. But they've gone on ahead. And so you're not leaving them behind. And if they can see you, they want you better. You know, so being able to say, it's okay for me to go on. It doesn't mean I'm going to forget them. It doesn't mean that I didn't care about them. But it does mean that I realize they've gone on ahead and are in a safe place.
Hmm. So what's a healthy way to celebrate the anniversary of a tragic incident? I mean, realistically, there's a drinking culture within first responders and military, so maybe that's going to be a little bit of an element. Maybe we just lay off that a little bit. But what are other healthy ways? Do you go visit a graveside? Do you have a party? Do you sit alone in your room and kind of just sulk? What's the deal?
And I'm glad you bring that up, because everybody grieves differently. Some people grieve very quietly. Some people grieve loudly. Some people want to grieve with people. Some people want to grieve by themselves. And however you grieve, that's fine. Do what you need to do. And also understand that your coworkers may grieve differently than you. Your family may grieve differently than you. There really is no right or wrong way. But what I would say is always ask yourself, is the way I'm grieving or is the way I'm framing this making me better or crashing me? If it's crashing you, then stop doing it. Do what works. Don't do what doesn't work. It's real basic. And so every year, if you crash and burn, then you're doing something wrong and you need to figure that out. Not wrong, but you're not helping yourself. You need to be in your own corner. So what works? Well, maybe writing the letter this year that you've been avoiding for a long time, guys, that I've been telling you for years. You know, maybe that's what you need to do. Maybe you need to talk to a friend about it. Maybe you need to let that person go and let that person be okay. You know, I've talked about this visualization many times on here, but I think it's an important one. If you believe in a higher power, maybe you see that higher power's hands come down and you put whoever you lost in those hands and say, okay, God, I'm off duty. They're yours now. And I'm going to leave them in your hands, trusting that you are now on duty and you're going to take care of them. They're no longer my responsibility. I will always care about them, but I'm not on duty anymore. And allowing yourself to step back. Because a lot of it is allowing yourself to let go. And I think sometimes people almost feel like it's their responsibility to punish themselves or to keep themselves connected to the tragedy. And somehow that makes them a better person. And all it does is make you miserable and your family miserable. And your friend who is long gone wants you to heal.
So celebrating the anniversary of a tragic event from a family's perspective, what should the family do? Do they bring it up? Do they not bring it up? How do they act in a healthy way?
And I think that's a conversation that probably should happen way before the event. You know, so for instance, Minkler, February 25th, how about you have that conversation in, I don't know, October, you know, and kind of go, okay, this year, what would you like us to do? What would be helpful? And I think that's true always of anything to do with trauma. The more you can give your family feedback, if you're irritable, let them know why. Don't just let them think that you hate them. We've said that many times, but I think it bears repeating. Don't tell them nothing's wrong when something's wrong. But family, if the person says they don't want to talk about it, give them that space as well. They have the right to not talk about it if they don't want to talk about it. But, you know, sometimes it may just be the person sitting in a room by themselves for 30 minutes and just thinking about it and going, wow, that was a tough day. I'm glad it's over. I'm sorry for the people we lost, but I'm going to go be with my family. Mm-hmm. You know, other people may go do something fun. One of the things I've often told departments, I don't know if they ever do it, but I've told them, and I've also told families this when they lose somebody, is to make a book of life. And I really like books of life that include pictures and funny comments that person made, funny stories. Everybody gets to add to it. Families that have lost a family member, I tell them, especially those first anniversaries, bring out that book of life and write down, gosh, I remember one Christmas, my dad or my mom or something like that. So that it's not that the person's there, but you almost feel like you're including them in that day.
Yeah.
You know, and so
it's almost kind of like, I'm Mexican. The Mexican culture is like, you know, the Day of the Dead,
yes,
Dia de los Muertos. Somebody just recently mentioned that to me, like, well, you're Mexican, you deal with death a lot better because you celebrate, you know, with your family and stuff. And it's kind of true. Like, yeah. It's still a sad experience, but it's also like when the anniversary comes of their death, or, you know, every October we get to kind of celebrate it and remember those good things and do that book of life type of thing. So for sure. What I want to also talk about, Jana, and get your perspective on is from the community perspective. So let's say someone's involved with the Porterville incident and they're your neighbor or they're your coworker's husband or whatever the case may be. And you just, is it okay to ask them about the incident? Is it not okay? What's the correct thing to do?
Oh, that's such a good question. And it's such an important one. And I think there's different ways of dealing with it, but I think it's a lot better just to say, hey, I was just thinking about you. Hope you have a good day. Rather than, hey, what happened? Please don't do that. Because we're trying to get their system cooled down. And the more you ask, the more heated up they get. I usually tell my guys and gals that are first responders, don't respond to the text messages and the calls, or do a very brief response. Don't call them and tell them all the details of the event. Just say, hey, thanks for thinking about me. I'll catch up with you later. You know, keep it very short, very simple. Because what a lot of them will do is they'll answer those calls, and then every single person is going to say, hey, what happened? And are you okay? And then they feel like they have to tell everybody everything. I'm like, no, we're trying to cool your system down. Because right now it's like we put airplane fuel into a Volkswagen and you're burning really hot. And so we need to cool that system down. And that means you need to do something fun and watch something funny on TV. You don't need to be talking about the event over and over. It's just going to heat that system up. Then you're not going to sleep. Then you're not going to have REM sleep. Then your brain isn't going to heal. And it's just this horrible spiral down.
And Dr. Sharps, any more wrap-up thoughts before we move on?
I think a lot of the important things have been covered here. It is very important to recognize that a tragedy is in the past. It's not happening right now. And one of the best ways to do that is to get at that relational information that, okay, this is here, this is now. We're celebrating, perhaps, the person's life rather than more or less having a rerun happening as central information in our heads. You mentioned alcohol a while back. Alcohol is one of the very best ways of divorcing yourself from your immediate reality and putting yourself right back in the traumatic situation. So one thing I often tell people is if you really right now feel you need a drink, that's the time not to have one. And so if you can keep yourself grounded in the immediacy of right now, physical reality has moved on, the tragedy is not here anymore, and paying attention to what Dr. Price-Sharps said in terms of how to deal with your own personal styles of grief. These are things that, you know, from the scientific standard are the things that are logical or rational. That's how you're best going to be able to deal with the situation. I often talk about psychological technologies where you make use of specific techniques, and the techniques she's outlined are the ones that are going to be most effective.
Dr. Sharps, I wanted to ask you something that actually came across my mind, and I thought about our last episode. We talked a little bit about sleep, and I got a lot of feedback on that. Mm-hmm. I noticed, I actually got to witness firsthand a lot of these guys in this incident this past week weren't sleeping. They're out there working endlessly to try to find the guy who was unaccounted for and conclude the incident. What's the importance of getting sleep, A, and B, what's the body doing when you just have all this adrenaline, you can't go to sleep, and you want to accomplish the mission at hand?
Yeah, that's very, very important. There's a variety of ways that Dr. Price-Sharps can speak to better than I can of reducing that adrenaline factor. But, you know, our bodies are programmed to be able to deal with emergencies, and you can go without sleep for a while as you're dealing with whatever it is. But there's a cost to that, okay? Nobody knows exactly what sleep is doing. There's a variety of theories about it, but we do know that sleep is important for allowing memories to be processed in an appropriate way so that you wind up with memories that are working, that are non-pathological, that aren't going to suddenly, you know, burst in on you. And we know that if you don't sleep, for example, okay, two aspects of sleep, REM, rapid eye movement, and slow wave sleep. Well, if those are interrupted, there's a variety of different things that happen, but you're not going to consolidate the memories. Okay, if we keep waking you up out of slow wave sleep tonight, you're going to have more trouble remembering what you learned today. And so that's a term we borrow from engineering, positive feedback, where a thing, it doesn't mean it's good, it's where a thing adds to itself. So, well, the trauma produces sleep disturbance, which produces more problems with processing the trauma, which then produces more problems, including more problems with sleep disturbance, which causes you with more, more incorrect, more damaging ways of processing that information. And again, the brain is better at processing the core of a thing. These are the things that happen, rather than, yes, but these are the things that happened a long time ago someplace else. You process the central more than the peripheral. And so the sleeplessness and, you know, anything you're doing chemically, the alcohol, et cetera, or, you know, one thing that lots and lots of first responders do, caffeine, you keep yourself awake, okay? And that's going to have downstream consequences. It's not going to process the information in a healthy way.
Jana, do you want to kind of touch on the sleep thing and not allowing yourself to sleep and hyping yourself up on Red Bull or Monster, whatever your fix is?
And of course, that's what they do, and that's how you keep yourself functioning. But like Dr. Sharp said, there's a fallout from that. But the other thing that I wanted to mention is about 4 or 5 days after the incident, people crash. And they may not go to sleep. Hopefully they go to sleep. But their body begins to crash, and all that adrenaline begins to start breaking down. And now it's sitting in their joints, and they feel like they have the flu. And they're very depressed, and they can't think, and they hurt all over, and they don't know what's going on. Anything that goes way up is going to crash way down. And so just understand that crash is coming, and that's okay. That means that's your body telling you stop. Go watch funny movies, eat some protein, eat some fun food, and just be still and let your body heal, because it's going to happen. And it's going to happen with all those guys. And then it freaks them out because they're so depressed, but really it's their body just crashing. And so if they'll just let their body do what it needs to do, in a couple days they'll pop back out of that. But they have to rest. They just have to take that time. And this is not the time to go to, I don't know, Disney. You know, it's time to not be around a lot of people, time to take it really slow, and time to just allow the whole body to rehabilitate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just to kind of wrap things up on this incident is... you know, you want to do what you can to remember those two guys who were taken in the line of duty. But you really, and I think Gary Taylor on the last episode really put the nail in the coffin. It was that you got to remember the guys who are living. You got to remember the guys who are still suffering from that incident that are living, because that's also very important and often overlooked. So
there's a lot of people that were impacted by Minkler. Yeah. And to this day, and it's been a number of years ago, and I still have guys that come in and are talking about Minkler. And so the more you can close those memories and not forget, but make them historical rather than current. Right. But you know what? And I know you feel this way, Chandler, as well. Thank you for all that you do to all you first responders. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. And Jana, just real quick, I want to move on to another segment here real quick. But if people want to get in touch with you or feel they need some help, what's the best way to go about doing that?
They're welcome to text me, 559-908-4162. Please tell me your name when you text me. The second thing is you can also email me. And the easiest email, the shortest one, is J, as in my first name, COP as in law enforcement, DOC as in doctors. So jcopdoc@aol.com.
And just to kind of end on a little bit of a happier note, I want to just ask both of you guys what you've gotten out of doing this podcast, and what do you enjoy about it?
I just love that people have a resource, you know, and to me, I don't know, my work is all about empowering people to take control of their own lives, to heal, to feel better, to watch their families heal, to watch their kids heal. And I just love being a part of the podcast. I love working with first responders. I love what I do.
Awesome. What about you, Matthew?
First responders tend to be people who are fixers. They want solutions to things. And when you start dealing with mental and emotional events, often the solutions are not evident. Okay, things seem to be hitting you out of left field that don't really make sense systematically. One of the things I think we can do with these podcasts, and also with the science involved, is to basically create what we hope is a correct framework, an accurate real-world framework for understanding these things. The basis of solution is understanding. And if you have an understanding, rather than various aspects of my mind keep ambushing me and attacking me, this is the way the mind works. We understand that now, at least to the degree that it's possible. We understand the systematics. Once we have the systematics, we're in a position to develop, again, this term I use, psychological technologies. We're in the position of treating the mind not as a machine. We're not suggesting it's just an engineering problem, but of creating reasonable tactics for successful living, where you can actually be successful, you know, within your own life, with your family, and operationally. All of that comes together. But it's got to be based on that understanding. And I think this kind of, you know, synthetic way of looking, synthetic in terms of putting things together, okay, what information is actually doing and what you can do with it clinically, winds up being very, very effective, very important.
Awesome. Guys, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.